surface area, at what point does it keep getting better and better as you're getting wider? And I would guess at some point it starts to degrade. And I'm guessing when you start getting close to being maybe a quarter width, a quarter wavelength wide, because now you're almost becoming a square or a round sphere rather than an antenna. So it's just confusing to think about at what point does the width get better and better, and where does it start degrading? So how do you even look at that?
Okay, Chris. Well, you are right. There is the skin effect. Most of RF energy is sheer microns on the surface of any conductor. So a hollow conductor will give you about the same current carrying capacity as a solid one. There might be some thermal issues where a solid will be able to dissipate more heat. But as far as the current itself, it's taking a strip on the surface. Different pure diameter radiating antenna. One is that goes back to what Andy mentioned. The actual total insertion loss resistance of the antenna diminishes. It isn't that much of an important factor with copper, which is highly conductive. The amount of insertion that is decreased by making their diameter larger. That's what I mean, though, is that the wider the diameter of the radiating antenna, the lower the Q of the antenna, which translates it for us as the wider the bandwidth. So in other words, if you had, say, an 80-meter antenna that was 22 gauge, and somehow you swapped it out for a 5-inch pipe, your 80 meters with that conductor wider bandwidth than the downside introduces mechanical limitations. Larger surface areas sway more, and you have to build stronger mechanical systems to hold them. Let me drop for a sec.
Don't we have to try?
Now, as an aside, you do not have to have a solid piece of wire. You do not even need necessarily to have a hollow cylinder. RF doesn't really recognize gaps in it as long as you keep them significantly below a wavelength. So there are things called cage antennas, which are basically, instead of a solid radiating core, they're just cages conductive material that the RF thinks radiator with that massive diameter thickness and that low Q and high and wide bandwidth.
So K2STP. So if I, in my case, I have a 1-inch wide piece of copper that will wrap around this pole, I said, why not use a 2-inch or a 3-inch or a 4-inch? Is there some kind of formula or method that you use and say, at what width are you? Is it too wide? Or is that not the case? Does it never get too wide?
It also is affected by the thickness of your wallet.
Yes, Ed makes a point. I kind of inferred that through the mechanical limitations. With mechanical limitations come wallet limitations as well, wouldn't you say, Ed?
Absolutely. The more metal you're putting into an antenna, you're paying for that. And it isn't the trade-off begins to become not very big the fatter you get. So at first it's a big trade-off, but then it just starts getting really big. You don't really get much benefit. It tapers off.
I agree, but what's your opinion of cage antennas? That's a kind of way of sneaking it through the laws of physics and not being quite as impactful on your pocketbook or on your mechanical abilities.
Yes, the cage-type antenna, which is like two birdcage-type structures, will definitely give you a very wide bandwidth, but usually the hams, you don't really need all that bandwidth, so, after a while, it becomes law of diminishing returns. There are some military applications that want a really wide bandwidth, and it comes in handy.
Okay, but I think on most bands I would agree with you. I think when you get down to 80 meters, there's a lot of guys arguing and yelling about how to broaden the bandwidth of their standard 80-meter dipole. You have to sort of make a choice. So unless you have a good antenna tuner, you have to decide whether you want to really spend your time on the 75-meter phone band or on the 80-meter CW side.
The antenna tuner is probably the most practical way to go, because even an 80-meter antenna, it starts getting very heavy and very expensive when you use a lot of heavy water.
Yeah, I agree with you, Ed. This is primarily a theoretical discussion. It's just that, for all intents and purposes, there's no law of physics that requires you to have a certain thickness of your conducting radiating antenna. The limitations are physical and mechanical, not really electrodynamic.
Yeah, but the bandwidth goes with the thickness, but it's usually easier, like for 80 meters, you're better off with an antenna tuner if you go from 75 to 80.
It's just, we're working this up as a theoretical construct as opposed to a practical. I wouldn't suggest that many people really get cage antennas or build antennas with very, very wide copper pipes for a bunch of reasons, the least of which is just the amount of money. So I was just kind of waxing theoretical. But getting back to Chris's question, I don't think that there is an inherent limitation except that it doesn't really give you much benefit after a certain point. So to keep it small, tidy, and cost-effective, would probably be the primary consideration with limiting the length of the copper your barber pole antenna design.
Gotcha, understood. I like the idea that it does a wider bandwidth. That's very interesting. I can kind of throw a wrench into this because talking about the 80 meter length antenna, obviously the wider, I get his point, it would get expensive and difficult and heavy and everything. But what about like a 23 centimeter antenna, which is fairly short? So that could end up just like a round ball or a square ball if you approach the thickness of a half wavelength wide. It's the same width as how tall it is. Would that do anything? I wonder if anyone has tried that.
Bowtie antenna.
Do you want to expand on the bowtie antenna for Chris?
At higher frequencies, it's very common. As a matter of fact, UHF TV antennas sometimes have bow tie shaped elements. It's called a bow tie because it looks a little bit like a bow tie, two triangles that come to a common point. Very common in UHF.
And what is the purpose of that? Is that so they get a wider bandwidth, or is it more of a beam type antenna? What's the purpose of that bow tie antenna?
No, just wider bandwidth. you sometimes see a bow tie or several bow ties in front of a reflector. That's the directionality, but the bow ties are basically dipoles.
Interesting. I have to, I'll Google that, take a look at them. Interesting. It's a interesting thing to look at, though, and it got me really thinking about it, which is heat. I'm about to wrap around a pipe and see how that works. But thank you, Roy. I appreciate it.
Well, I wish you good luck with that. Yeah, just touching upon the 23-centimeter band, it's true that you could make it ridiculously thick and it wouldn't be as cost prohibitive or mechanically problematic, but the flip side is that when you take the percentage of the band versus the frequency range, it's a much more narrow bandwidth than 80 meters. 80 meters is probably the widest bandwidth that you're going to ask your amateur radio antenna to deal with. So you don't really need that broad a bandwidth antenna for a 23-centimeter antenna design. So that's why they're not really designed ultra-wide band, because they really don't need it.
Sure, understood. Thank you. K2-STP.
Oh, and one more thing. Those bow-tie antennas are usually very thin. It's almost like a sheet of paper thick in the shape of a bow-tie.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate your assistance. Thanks, Chris, for his question. Does anyone else have any technical questions tonight? Because it's only 9:26. I do have a couple of little puzzles that I'd like to share with you people. They're kind of agricultural, kind of food-related, but they're still, I think, dressing, so we'll try those. But first, I'll ask if anyone has any questions or topics of their own. Okay, nothing heard. We'll basically open it up for anything about science, technology, even medicine, as long as it's not a personal question.
KG2CKG.
Yes, what's your first name?
The handle is Josh, Juliet Oscar Sierra Hotel. I have kind of a general question about the repeater. I'm here on 75 right now, and I'm normally coming on an 850, but over the last year, the signal strength just changes to me all of the time. It's really odd. Now I've heard some of the struggles that were going on that node tonight, so I'm wondering if it's just, you know, some kind of technical difficulty I'm often hearing about. I'm here at the top of Westchester County now after I moved out of Brooklyn. Go ahead.
Yeah, the repeater unfortunately has had some problems. It primarily operates using a station master antenna, and it's my understanding that station masters have this somewhat tendency under a lot of heavy wind conditions. It develops microfractures and such, and so it started to fail us in interesting ways. At first, the problem presented itself as bouts of static, where people would be talking and then all of a sudden it would just make this really bad static noise and cut off, and you couldn't really talk much. So the receiver portion was modified to another antenna. That worked for a little while, but then the power failed out of the transmitter and was found to be a complete antenna failure for the station master. So they placed a temporary antenna in position for both receiving and transmitting. I don't think its gain is quite as good, so I'm not quite sure how omnidirectional it might be in the position that they put it, but It's a different position. It's a different antenna. There's also some concerns about some possible desensing going on. So there's a bunch of little problems that need to be addressed. I'm operating through, yet again, the UHF link because from Gravesend, I can't trigger the repeater right now. I was able to do it Tuesday after they swapped the antenna, but the propagation dropped a little bit or something, and I couldn't even trigger it. So I'm working through a link myself right now.
Okay, USL, sounds like, all right, so this is some of the experience I've been having on 850. I just thought, you know, I didn't remember any of that when I was down in Brooklyn, and it's like a different repeater depending on what week it is. The thing that I'm not sure of is the signal strength, because I think you're just speaking mostly on the receive side, but I often get the receive signal much differently here that I'm receiving. Go ahead.
Initially, when they put the new... less signal than the old antenna in the good old days. That's kind of creeped up a little bit lately, so it's close to the output power that I know and love so well. But again, I have a doubt whether it's truly a perfectly omnidirectional and non-obstructed position. So I think that there are some people who are getting the signal better than other people.
For me, it depended which day it was. I was like ready to purchase test gear to try and figure out the issue, but I see it's, you know, obviously it's an operational thing. And thank you so much for that sanity check. I really appreciate it. I didn't know what was happening up on the roof there, so probably not so much. Okay, well, thank you so much. KD2CKD, and I'll be listening.
Okay, very good, Josh. Yeah, I always like to help people make sure that they're still safe. I went through the same thing about a month ago, and I couldn't get into the repeater, and I was seriously trying every antenna and every radio that I had, and nothing was working for me. If I boost up the power to about 150 watts, I can get through, but after a while, bits and pieces of my shack will start to melt.
Okay, well, QSL, thank you again. That's a tremendous sanity check because it's, you just always think it's you and nobody else, so appreciate it. Okay, KD2CKD.
You're welcome, Josh. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, Roy, net control of this, the Weimar Technical Nest, going on since 1982. So once again, if anyone has any other technical questions, topics, science, medicine, what have you, otherwise, I'll give you the puzzles that I've collected over the last few days. Okay, I don't know if Andy is still available. He mentioned that he has to go to work early tomorrow morning. Andy, are you available? No, David, I think he's kind of signed out for the time being. Is it a question that I could perhaps help you with?
Sure. I could ask a question to you. Let's say you have perfectly resonant half-wave dipole, and you want to put it under the roofing shingles of your house, so nobody can see it, you know? By an act of God or some other thing, could that antenna work to a certain extent to receive first to transmit second? Or let's say you have a resonant half-wave dipole and you have to bend to fit it into a space, you know? Maybe it's at a 100-degree angle, 90-degree angle like that, you know? Could that also be an advantage for the antenna in certain cases where, you know, you can't fit it straight in there? Back to you, Roy.
Most efficient way of dealing with an oversized dipole is to keep the legs relatively straight and to incline it, the so-called inverted V configuration. As long as you don't have that angle at anything narrower than 90 degrees, it shouldn't be a problem. If for whatever reason you can't angle it that way, that you have to put a crimp in the antenna, the closer to the edges of the antenna that you do it, probably the better, because of the distribution, as Andy mentioned, that the current distribution of a resonant antenna is maximum at its C point in the middle. So you want to have the middle to be kink-free, relatively speaking. If the edges where the currents are very low and the amount of RF radiated is significantly lower, a little bit kinked, it won't introduce too much complication to the radiating pattern.
It's into a space. You put one hand is higher, the middle is a little bit lower, and the other side is lower than that. But, you know, the angle, maybe 100 degrees angle of the antenna, so it's not straight, you know. Could that essentially work? I mean, according to the book, they probably say, don't do it, you know. But you do it anyway, and somehow it works, you know. Isn't that sort of like the fun of, like, trying to get your antenna to put out a signal to receive a signal?
Ed was doubling with you, so we'll get back to Ed in a second. It is quite fun. Antennas don't usually just completely fail. There's a spectrum of usefulness. There's a degree of efficiency. A perfectly designed half-wave dipole has a given efficiency, and if you put a bunch of compromises, if you shorten it and put an inductor to take up the excessive capacitance that shortening creates, if you twist and turn it, you might slightly diminish the efficiency. You might slightly modify the directionality of it. But, you know, antennas, unless you really screw it up or you don't connect sensor feed, it don't work to one degree or another. And you know, all of our antennas are compromised antennas. We try and fit the theory as well as we can practically do, and we judge the results and decide whether or not we're happy with them or whether we want to tinker some more. But I look forward to Ed's response as well. Ed, what did you want to say?
Two items. I once wanted to put up a 20-meter dipole, which is 16 feet on the side. I only had 28 feet, so I had two L-shaped things with the ends hanging down. Worked perfectly. Second item, every antenna, no matter what you do, no matter how good or how bad, has an impedance and a radiation pattern. If you can match the impedance, whatever the pattern is, you'll get something out of it.
You know, I know there's some directionality with that antenna up on the roof. It works pretty good. My mentor said better to make your antenna straight if you can. I told him I couldn't make it straight, it's bent. The antenna's bent, he said, does it work? I said, yeah. He said, don't change it.
Okay, like I said before, we all compromise from the theoretical drawings that we see, and most of the time we're happy with it, and that's great. But occasionally some people just aren't happy with it, and they just keep on tinkering.
QSL, QSL. And that's part of the fun of it, I guess. And I think when you finally get it to work, you just leave it there. You know, I've had that antenna up there for 4 or 5 years straight. You know, I didn't have to fix it. I didn't have to mend it. I didn't have to solder it. You know, it's basically just up there, you know. And I got to be thankful for that.
Yes, you do. You know, the second order of thermodynamics, entropy always increases. Given enough time, everything breaks. So be thankful for that. It depends. Different people have different likes and dislikes. I know a guy who rotates because he trades it in for another one, and he enjoys it that way. I know other people who tinker with antenna design. They're always sitting around with programs that simulate antennas and VNAs to figure out what they've built is doing, and they're always tinkering with antennas. You know, and some people do this hobby just to talk, and others do it to expound on theory. You know, whatever floats one's boat.
I just saw some noise.
You know, telephone lines. I had a dipole for every band. They're all set up over my my father and mother's house. And I built them from scrap, you know, from rejected coaxial cable and wire. For $5, we bought a box of wire, you know, and it all worked really great. You know, worked the world on CW. And I just remember those times of building dipoles and stringing them up.
Yeah, by the way, Ed, I heard you doubled with David again. I'll get to you in 1 second. But yeah, I mean, wire antennas are pretty much the easiest to build yourself if you're so inclined. You can go for the ultra deluxe copper clad steel, you know, as strong as wire can get. Or you can just use zip wire from speaker wire. Or, you know, if you're real playing it, inexpensive aluminum wire, which I wouldn't suggest because of a bunch of things. It gets brittle in the cold weather and it breaks more easily than copper. But, you know, wire antennas, inexpensive, and you can reuse the wire for something else. So, yeah, it's always... If you're so inclined and you're a tinkerer and you want to experiment, then, you know, get yourself some inexpensive wire and just go crazy. But, Ed, you wanted to point out something.
Here is a fascinating case of study. Every decent-sized airplane has an HF radio and an HF antenna. And what they always do is they take the top of the tail and they run a wire to a pylon, usually behind the flight deck. And I can assure you, the designers of the plane give zero consideration to how well that length antenna will resonate. They get good antenna tuners. And they go anywhere from 3 to 30 megahertz with that combination, and it always seems to work pretty well.
Stop. Have it. And again, you'll find arguments on HF. There are a bunch of guys hiding around, you know, 75 meters, who, if you say the word antenna tuner, they jump at you and tell you that it's all a trick, it's all a scam, you're fooling your transmitter, you're fooling yourself, and on and on and on they go. But in the real world, if you have a good, efficiently designed antenna tuner and a low-loss transmission line, you could go all over the damn place. I used to joke with people that my PALSTAR antenna tuner, I could tune a doorknob if I had to.
Base loaded coupling is the standard.
Is the standard for airplanes or is the standard for all antenna tuners?
So, for hams. there is no airplane so small that you can't use more than a coupling for an antenna.
In touch. One of his favorite topics. Decimal dipole.
Well, you know, there were two examples of antennas that I thought were very, very well done. One of them was a three-element 40-meter antenna made with wire. So, you know, it only had one direction. And the other one was a 16-element 20-meter dipole made with wire that was strung up in pine trees.
How do you have a 16-element dipole?
By mistake. 16-element beam antenna. It was a directional antenna. 16-element made with wire strung up in a pine tree.
Sure, why not?
Why you cannot make a Yagi type of antenna out of just bare wire. You're not going to have the mechanical stability of being able to put it on a rotator, but if for stationary use, you have one element that's radiating, you have one element behind it a little bit longer as the passive reflector, and you have a number of passive directors in front of it, you have a very, very high gain antenna. Works fine. Can't move it around much, but if you point it in the right direction and you only need it in that direction, works great.
I'll take any direction that I can get, you know, but a bent span dipole, you know, and it saves Europe and Africa and South America, you know, that's good enough for me.
Okay, again, it depends upon the individual. If someone kind of hands you the controls of a highly directional Yagi that's pointed exactly in the opposite direction to the people that you want to talk to, it's not as useful. If it's pointing it in the direction of where you want to talk to, it's very useful. That's why most Yagis are designed more mechanically sturdy and usually placed on rotators, because most people want to be able to change directions. Even repeaters, if they use a rotator and a Yagi, they like to point it at different repeaters. So it depends as all kinds of things. Everything, again, is a compromise. You have to decide which compromise you could live with and which you can't.
WS2N.
I'm so happy to get at least two or three good loud signals on 17 meters that I could talk to them. And, you know, it's like, that's I think, for me, what ham radio is all about.
Okay, if it meets your criteria, then that's great. You're doing a good job with it. I noticed Paul doubled with you a little bit. Paul, you want to say something?
Yes, you were talking about the putting the reflector and the director, you know, in the middle of nowhere. I did that in the trees. I put up a dipole, 20 meters, and I did exactly what you said, Roy. I made one longer, and I put that in the trees, you know, for the reflector, and one for the one shorter for the director. And I pointed, you know, I set it up. My goal was to I wanted to get into Japan. You know, I was trying to go for all these different countries. I said, let me try to get Japan. So I tried, I kept it like that for a couple of weeks. Sure enough, one day I did contact Japan. I finally got the QSL card from him. In those days, it took like 6 months or sometimes a year to get one. But I did get it. Now, whether or not it would have worked without these homemade reflector or homemade... disconnected and, see what the difference was. But anyway, as far as I'm concerned, it worked. Back to you, Roy.
Roy,
reason why it shouldn't work. I mean, I have read articles where people have put a phase in solenoids, and they've figured out ways to electromechanically alter the directionality, switching in and out reflector and directors and such. But yeah, I mean, if you have a goal in mind, it's a lot easier to point your reflector and your director at the right direction. And it probably did something. I don't know how many decibels of gain you got in directionality, but it certainly probably helps.
Roy, WD3AZ with hands on screen.
Okay, very good, Roy. I heard the other station. Go ahead.
Roy, think about this. 36 five-element Yagis in a broadside array, each one with its own phase shifter. Been there, done that. Want to hear about the performance?
Suddenly.
It had about a 5-degree beam width and 21 decibels of gain, and you could steer it over a reasonable angle. Let me put it this way. This was for an air traffic control application, and the force was that antenna alone was far more than your house.
Well, prices of real estate have been going up, but as a possibility. Well, that reminds me of Dick K2RIW's QSL car, the incredible Yagi array that he had hooked up when he was, doing other things, but I think he had designed that for moon bouncing. Along with Barry, probably had something very similar, N2MB.
Yeah, I've seen the photos. That was definitely the moon bounce.
Yeah, it's sort of a shame that there's a kind of a fight among moon bouncers today, because you had the previous generation who didn't have the benefit of these Joe Taylor algorithms for very, 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 very low signal strength transmission reception. And you have these newer guys just pointing a damn Yagi up at the moon and getting back a signal, and these guys who had to put up these incredible arrays and powerful amplifiers. And, I feel bad for both sides, because they're both kind of angry at each other, I feel.
Well, back in the old days, it was mostly homebrew.
Also, you still have to limit yourself to slow-speed CW because the moon is a very mushy reflector.
There are those limitations, but I mean, nowadays, they actually, Joe Taylor and a couple of his colleagues have come up with a new low-noise algorithm. These are primarily, I think, designed for meteor scatter, I think, and also for ultra-low-frequency transmission. So he's still working on these algorithms, and they're getting better and better, and people are using them. And I don't know if anyone does moon bounce the old-fashioned way anymore.
Oh.
tell you, that was quite an experience. My teacher's buddy had a 4 over 4, 16 elements per each antenna, tilt and turn, and it was all homebrew.
Well, yeah, as you go farther and farther back, more and more was homebrew. I mean, and even in microwave, most microwave, most bleeding-edge microwave amateur radio use is people cobbling it together themselves. Recently, there have been a couple of companies that started to produce models for guys that just don't have the time and the electrical engineering knowledge to hammer them together. But yeah, there are still little bits, pieces, and avenues and areas in amateur radio that the commercial manufacturers simply haven't gotten to yet. And so it's homebrew for those guys. They're doing all kinds of interesting things. There's switching linear amplifiers on AM devices being used down in 75 meters. There's microwave guys that kind of go to mountaintops and try and break records of line-of-sight distances. There's still a lot of very clever hands out there building a lot of clever machinery. We kind of just look at the stuff in the ads for the magazine. But there's still a lot of work going on, thankfully.
Yeah, even his microwave amplifier, linear amplifier, homebrewed to specification. I think it was about a kilowatt, maybe a kilowatt and a half. It was pretty incredible. For me, I'm really happy with 100 watts and a dipole. Where's the world on 100 watts and a dipole?
Well, like anything, it's what you want to get out of the hobby. For you, that works. There are other people out there who just want to do CW. They don't like phones. They don't like the data that needs computers. And, you know, great, wonderful. And there are experimenters who spend almost all their time on the microwave band. And there are other guys who spend almost all of their time on the loafer band. Loafers are what they call the guys who use the experimental ultra-low and very low-frequency band. That's the beauty of this hobby. I've said it before, and I'll probably say it again. The depth and the breadth. There are so many different aspects. There are so many different levels, and there's a place for all of us, fortunately.
Thank you, Roy. You know, I had this thought of SEO and Google ranking for websites. Maybe I'll save it for next week.
Okay, I mean, we'll get to the puzzle tonight. SEO is an interesting topic. It's probably more up Ken's alley, but I've dabbled in that aspect as well. So if you want to take it as a question next week, that's fine.
Thank you, Roy. Appreciate it. Have a fantastic night. Good night. KG2R1.
You too, David. Let's do a couple little puzzles. I don't know if anyone's up to them because I haven't done them in a long time, so you might be out of practice of responding. So we'll take this as a test flight. They're not esoteric. I assure you there are no equations. There's no physics involved. It's a pure eating product. So I got three questions for tonight. First question is, what's the difference between a white egg and a brown egg, and is one better than the other? Okay, we'll try again. I don't know. Gentlemen, try to answer. I can't quite make out most of his transmission. So if you want to try again, you can.
W2ASC.
WB2KWC. Yes, Ken, do you want to answer that particular question?
Okay, I don't have any particular knowledge, but I'm guessing it's simply the diet or an environment of the chicken producing the shell, and it has nothing to do with the contents of the egg.
Okay, well, it's actually genetic. There are chickens that are just genetically designed so that when they produce eggshells, they have a brown color to them, and other chickens that are just designed without that coloration, they give you white eggs. Now, although brown eggs, I think, cost a little bit more, last time I looked, they're basically nutritionally identical. But, you know, people have their own belief system. So it's a genetic aspect that causes the difference between brown eggs and white eggs.
I have a question. Can you genetically alter a chicken to automatically give you Easter eggs?
Probably, if we were clever enough, we might be able to do it. There might be some problems in that it's very difficult to engineer the color blue. If you look around, there's very few organic things that are truly colored blue. They're, you know, purple, they're blue-green, but they're almost never blue.
That's all right. I'll give up blue.
Ryan, you said brown eggs are a genetic trait. Is it with individuals, or is it certain breeds of chickens producing brown eggs?
Difference, believe it or not, is actually the earlobe on the chicken that's laying the egg. So there's a certain color. I can't remember what it is. It may be blue, but it may be just because you were talking about that, but the earlobe on the chickens that lay the brown eggs have a different color earlobe. I don't know if it's blue or red or orange. I forget exactly, but that's actually the difference, or how you tell. They look at the earlobe, and that particular color will tell them if it will be a brown egg, K2SCC.
Okay, that's interesting. My question, having took in genetics, begs me to kind of ponder whether this is the same exact gene sequence that simply codes for the color brown in eggshell and also for a different color in a different region of the chicken, or if they are closely associated genes, you know, they're next to each other. So when one a gene gets transferred, it usually takes the other one along for the ride.
The genetic part, that I can't help you with, but I happen to know that fact. My father-in-law is in the egg business, and he once told me that. I found it very, I thought he was pulling my leg, but he wasn't kidding. He's serious.
Okay, very good, Chris. Chris, would you like to take a stab, although you probably already know, the second question is also chicken-related, so as long as you are a chicken expert, you want to try for the second puzzle question?
Bring it on.
Okay, so the question is, why are some eggs, the yellow of the eggs very yellow, and others very pale, and is one any better than the other?
Well, I can tell you that the very deep yellow eggs, usually just out of own experience, taste better. I traveled to Germany for many years for work, and I always found the eggs over there were darker yellow, the yolks were darker yellow than here. And they attributed it over there to their free-range chickens or whatever their chickens ran around rather than being in a factory like they are in America, but however that's changing. I don't remember exactly what causes it, but I do know eggs can sit for a very long time. The eggs we buy are sometimes sitting in warehouses for months, unrefrigerated, and that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, there's a whole strangeness about eggs. European eggs generally are not refrigerated. I think if you ask a European where you have your eggs, they'll show you to some cabinet. We put it in the refrigerator. I think so that some agricultural law requires them to process the eggs in such a way that after it's processed, it does sort of require refrigeration. I haven't been able to really come up with any sure thing. But the yellow of the egg is purely a dietary phenomenon. There's no genetics involved whatsoever. The same egg will produce different colored yellow eggs. It's carotene that colors it. So you could either free-range it, or what happens in the United States is they feed it flower petals that are high in carotene that give the bright orange-yellow coloration. So, you know, you might like it, you might not like it. It doesn't really have, you know, unless you're carotene deficient, it doesn't really add that much to it, per se. But that's the reason why chicken egg, yellow of the chicken egg is yellow as opposed to pale yellow. If you had them just eat the stuff that didn't have carotene, it would be a very, 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 very pale yellow.
K2SDP, it makes perfect sense. I could also ask you or tell you how to tell a fresh egg. It's very easy, actually.
Well, I know there's a thing about stale eggs, that they float, and eggs that aren't stale sink, or the other way around, but please tell me.
If you crack an egg open, you look at how high the yolk stands, and the higher it stands, the fresher it is. And in some instances, they don't want fresh eggs. I guess when they're hard boiling, you're better off with an egg that's not fresh because it loses some of its volume and there's some air around it, so the shell comes off easier, which is interesting. But the height of the yolk is really the important thing to look at.
Actually, that reminds me, I have an egg question, WB2EAD.
Okay, one second. We'll get to it. That probably has to do with the very, very, very slow evaporation of what little fluid is in a egg, changing the buoyancy to one degree or another. That's fascinating. I gotta take a good look at my eggs when I open them up. Okay, Ed, you wanted to say something or ask something?
I have a serious question. I can have raw eggs in the refrigerator for weeks and weeks with no detectable difference. But if we forget a hard-boiled egg in the refrigerator in about 10 days, it's complete. When you crack the shell, it smells of hydrogen sulfide. What is the difference why a hard-boiled egg will not last remotely as long as a raw egg?
Well, I'll ask Chris if he knows the answer to that. If I was guessing, I would simply suggest the possibility that the boiling, in order to give you the ultimate, you know, the boiling that you do for the egg, kind of disrupts the protective coating that the shell is designed to have. So having disrupted it, it's now open to all kinds of external contamination and bacterial growth. But Chris, if you know anything about that, please.
K2SDP, I don't know the answer to that, but your answer sounded perfectly reasonable. Over to you.
Okay, very good. Chris, so Ed, does it sound like a reasonable answer?
I don't have a better one. I'll go with that.
How long could eggs stay fresh in a refrigerator?
Weeks and weeks. Been there, done that.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really get, quote, rotten as much as they kind of dry out and kind of get thick, and the flavor shifts a little bit. So if you're really into eggs, you'll be able to tell a fresh egg from a not quite fresh egg. But it isn't sort of like milk in which one day it's decent and the next day it stinks.
So the outside amount of time is a month, would you say, eggs can last, fresh eggs last in a refrigerator?
Well, they do come with a bye-bye date, and all things being equal, you should try and keep up with it. But I have found times when my eggs were sitting in the fridge for more than 4 to 6 weeks after the bye date, and I smelled them, they smelled fine. I scrambled them, they scrambled fine. So, again, it's kind of a gradual decline. You know, when it gets to be a couple of months, it's definitely time to move them out into the garbage can. But other than that, they pretty much, as long as you maintain the integrity of the shell, you know, they seem to last in the refrigerator, at least for me.
I've had the exact same experience and would have given the exact same answer.
To SCP.
Okay, I'm going to, let me just see that if I have it here. Okay, one nice question, just for the general audience. This is not egg-related, so we're not going to lean too much on Chris, but he's always welcome to try his hand at this. My third and final agricultural question for the night is, does organic whole milk stay fresh any longer than regular whole milk?
USCP.
Yes, Chris, you have an answer?
Yeah, I would just venture to guess that the organic milk would spoil faster only because it hasn't been filtered or cleaned or homogenized or whatever the heck they do to milk. So that would be my guess, but I have no knowledge on it.
I have a theory.
With any other thoughts on the subject?
Yes, I do. Should I take it?
Cured by the identifier.
WD2EAD has some thoughts.
Certainly, give me your thoughts, Ed.
Regarding the previous content, I believe milk has to, by law, have to be pasteurized, and if it's not homogenized, it will separate the milk and cream, so it's not really that much different. But my point is, you can't really run the test, because I have found, depending on different brands, where you buy them, when you buy them, you get different shelf lives. I think it's what happens before you buy it is very variable that will completely skew your test results.
Absolutely.
that if it goes through a terrible experience, then it's not going to turn out well. But all things being equal, if you have 100 cartons of milk and they all have the exact same bye-bye date, well, no, it, it, it